This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Bill Machuga. I and Greg, the other broadcast reader for this morning, will be reading the front page of the Washington Post. And I will get started this Wednesday morning, May the 1st. And one of the articles on the front page of the Washington Post is under the heading of National. The headline, "College Tensions Take Hostile Turn as Expulsions Threatened Over Protests." This is written by Danielle Paquette, Hannah Natanson, and Abigail Hauschlohner. The standoff between student protesters and college administrators took a sharply hostile turn on campuses nationwide Tuesday as schools threatened expulsions and dismantled tent encampments, while police arrested more than 200 people demonstrating against the Israel-Gaza war. At Columbia University, police retook a barricaded classroom building in a major show of force. The dramatic scene climaxed about 9:15 p.m. when phalanxes of New York City officers outside the gates began moving onto the Columbia campus. The officers cleared the area around Hamilton Hall, which dozens of protesters had taken shortly after midnight, blocking entrances. The officers began sledgehammering their way in to pull them out. Another group of officers began entering the building via a truck ladder positioned into an upper floor window. Quote, "Protesters chose to escalate to an alarming and untenable situation, including by vandalizing property, breaking doors and windows, blockading entrances, and forcing our facilities and public safety workers out. And we are responding appropriately, as we have long made clear we would," Columbia spokesman Ben Chang said in a statement. Law enforcement officials had raised questions about the identities of those inside Hamilton. Some appeared to be not students, but, quote, professional outside agitators. New York Police Commissioner Edward Cabin said in a news conference early Tuesday evening, "Major Eric Adams advised parents to coax your children home." What transpired a couple hours later was first a shelter-in-place directive from the university, then the massing of police on both east and west sides of the Morningside Heights campus. Even before the officers started their operation, some faculty were harshly criticizing President Manoush Shafiq and Columbia trustee. "Columbia faculty have spent the day offering our help to defuse the situation on Columbia's campus and have been rebuffed or ignored," the statement said. "Armed police entering our campus places students and everyone else on campus at risk." A university letter released around the time police gave the all clear at 10 p.m. revealed that Shafiq has asked the department to retain a presence on campus through at least May 17 to maintain order and prevent protesters from again setting up encampments on the main lawn. Commencement is May 15. While Columbia has been the epicenter of the nation's student unrest this month, many other colleges and universities are facing the same daunting dilemma. as frustrations and antagonisms flare on all sides, how can academia strike the right balance between safety and free expression? From California to Texas to Florida, students continue to dig in their heels, with many refusing to stand down until their institutions slash financial ties to Israel and arms manufacturers that supply the Netanyahu government, among other forces they blame for that country's devastation of Gaza in retaliation for an October 7 attack by Hamas that killed about 1,200 Israelis. Few universities have signaled a willingness to change how they invest endowment funds. Though Brown University in Rhode Island became a notable exception Tuesday, officials there announced that 5 students will be allowed to meet with the corporation of Brown University in May to present their arguments for divestment. That board will then take a vote in October. This is a huge moment, not only nationally, but for the divestment movement on campus, said Arman Dindar, a 21-year-old junior and spokesperson for the Gaza Solidarity Encampment. The energy on campus has been electric. We're riding on this win. President Christina H. Paxson characterized the decision as a reflection of the university's DNA. Quote, Brown has always prided itself on resolving differences through dialogue, debate, and listening to each other, she said in a message to students. The 2 weeks of sometimes violent protests on private and public campuses have garnered global attention, provoking heated debate on Capitol Hill and cautious criticism from the Biden administration, which has urged students to avoid hateful rhetoric while exercising their First Amendment rights. The takeover of Columbia's Hamilton Hall, a building that has been occupied by student protesters several times since the late 1960s, is not an example of peaceful protest, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said Tuesday. A small percentage of students shouldn't be able to disrupt the academic experience. Democrats in Congress have called for efforts to, quote, lower the temperature. Republicans have demanded that college administrators quell the burgeoning demonstrations, which they assert are rife with anti-Semitism. The GOP's presumptive presidential nominee, Donald Trump, told reporters Tuesday that student protesters should face punishments similar to those meted out to his supporters prosecuted for their part in the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol. House Republican leaders announced a House-wide effort to crack down on anti-Semitism on college campuses and threatened to strip federal funding from some universities. The effort, which they said would include legislation and oversight investigations, underscores the deep political divisions that have emerged across the country over the depth of U.S. support for Israel. And we will be continuing to the next article here on, and the headline is The New Face of Flooding. On June 19, southern Mobile County, Alabama, experienced torrential rain and severe flooding. Roads and some homes near the Fowl River were submerged, but this was no ordinary flood. Theodore, Alabama, John Corradeo drove the solitary 2-lane highways of southern Alabama, eyeing the roadside ditches. It had been raining off and on for days, and Corradeo, chief of the Fowl River Fire District, knew that if it continued, his department could be outmatched by floodwaters. It kept raining. Water filled the ditches and climbed over roads, swallowing parts of a main highway. About 10 residents who needed to be rescued were brought back to the station in fire trucks. More remained stranded in floodwaters out of the department's reach. That week, we just caught hell, Corradeo said. What the residents and rescuers of the Fowl River region faced on that day was part of a dangerous phenomenon reshaping the southern United States. Rapidly rising seas are combining with storms to generate epic floods, threatening lives, property, and livelihoods. In the Fowl River's case, unusually high tides slowed floodwaters as they went downstream to drain. This increased the water's depth and flooded a wide expanse, even several miles upstream. The result was deluged roads, washed out cars, and damaged houses from a flood that was larger, deeper, and longer lasting due to rising seas. These supercharged floods are one of the most pernicious impacts of an unexpected surge in sea levels across the U.S. Gulf and southeast coasts, with the ocean rising an average of 6 inches since 2010, one of the fastest such changes in the world, according to a Washington Post examination of how sea level rise is affecting the region. The Post's analysis found that sea levels at a tide gauge near the Fowl River rose 4 times faster in 2010 to 2023 than over the previous 4 decades. The rapid burst of sea level rise has struck a region spanning from Brownsville, Texas, to Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, where coastal counties are home to 28 million people. Outdated infrastructure built to manage water, some of it over a century old, cannot keep up. As a result, the seas are swallowing coastal land, damaging property, submerging septic tanks, and making key roads increasingly impassable. Our canary in the coal mine for sea level rise is stormwater flooding, said Renee Collini, director of the Community Resilience Center at the Water Institute. Each inch up of sea level rise reduces the effectiveness of our stormwater to drain, and the only place left for it to go is into our roads, yards, homes, and businesses. To explore sea level rise in the region, the Post analyzed trends at federal tide gauges and drew on satellite data to compare the Gulf of Mexico with the rest of the globe. The Post also worked with Brett Webb, a coastal engineer at the University of South Alabama, to closely study the 2023 flood in the Fowl River region. A sophisticated river simulation Webb produced showed how higher seas would have turbocharged the flood, making it worse, with deeper waters covering a larger area for a longer time than if the same event had occurred in an era of lower seas. These analyses showed how much the ocean is rising and how it's affecting flooding across this region. A preview of what other parts of the U.S. and the world that are affected by sea level rise will face in coming decades. Human-caused climate change is driving an acceleration of sea level rise globally. largely because of the faster melting of the globe's giant sheets of ice. Scientists do not know for certain why this region is experiencing a surge in sea levels beyond the global average, but one theory is that naturally occurring ocean currents are moving ever warmer ocean water deep into the Gulf. This warm water expands and causes seas to rise. This comes on top of sinking land, which has long exacerbated sea level rise in the region. When I first moved here in 2007, the rule of thumb was a foot per century, Webb said. Well, looking back now, in the last 20 years, we've gotten half of that in a fifth of the time. The Fowl River region is a quiet inland expanse of flat spaces and pine forests filled with large riverfront homes, more modest dwellings, and a few mobile home parks. The wealthier inhabitants live along the wider stretches of the river and near the coast, and lower income residents generally populate rural areas upstream. The community is largely white, and population swells in the summer when people come to boat and fish in the river. Let me finish this article here. The rainfall on June 19 was dramatic, but not necessarily record-breaking. And the tide at the end of the Fowl River barely qualified as an NOAA high tide flooding event. But it was the confluence of these factors, Webb said, that made the flood extreme and highlights a phenomenon that is growing in frequency but has received little attention. Scientists in the United States have mostly focused on this type of collision of precipitation and tides, known as compound events, with hurricanes, not everyday rain events. But more local deluges are now attracting growing scientific attention. Webb's analysis shows that the sea level acceleration since 2010 was substantial enough to have an impact in the Fowl River flood, a finding that breaks new ground as scientists grapple with rising oceans. To simulate the flow of the water, Webb used modeling software designed by the federal government. He then drew on three sources of regional data to show how sea level rise made the flood worse. He mapped the river's channel and the height of the surrounding land and told the software how the river flows. To show the effect of rainfall on the river and height of the ocean, Webb used two sources of data, a river gauge 10 miles upstream and a tide gauge where the river empties into Mobile Bay. River levels swelled, filling the waterway as unusually high tides kept the excess rainfall from draining. As a result, the river leaped far beyond its banks. The sea level, which includes both the rise of the ocean and sinking of land, was the analysis's sole variable. It's the only thing that's changing in the model from scenario to scenario. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's move on to the third article I'll be reading this morning. Excuse me. Under health. Right after I cough. Attorney General moves to reclassify marijuana as lower risk drug. This is written by David Ovalle, Michael Scherer, Tyler Pager, Dan Diamond, and Finit Nirupil. Attorney General Merrick Garland on Tuesday recommended loosening restrictions on marijuana, a historic shift in federal drug policy that could broaden access to the drug for medicinal use and boost cannabis industries in states where it is legal. The measure, if enacted, would not legalize marijuana at the federal level, but still represents a milestone that could prove to be a political win for President Biden, who is campaigning for re-election and has sought to ameliorate racial and criminal justice inequities wrought by the nation's long war on drugs. The Justice Department submitted the formal recommendations to the White House on Tuesday, an agency spokeswoman said in a statement. It follows the Drug Enforcement Administration's approval of a federal health agency recommendation that marijuana be reclassified. The White House's Office of Management and Budget must review the measure, according to people familiar with the matter. The proposal, if accepted, would be formally published and would not go into effect for months until the public has a chance to comment. The DEA's approval was first reported Tuesday by the Associated Press. The DEA, the Justice Department, and the White House declined to comment. For more than five decades, marijuana has been classified as a Schedule I controlled substance with a high potential for abuse and no accepted medical use in the same tier as heroin. Under the Justice Department's proposed change, marijuana would go to the less risky Schedule III in the same category as prescription drugs such as ketamine, anabolic steroids, and testosterone. The historic policy shifts comes as marijuana is easier than ever to obtain and has become an industry worth billions of dollars in the United States. The majority of Americans now live in states where they can legally buy weed. 38 states and D.C. have legalized medical marijuana programs, and 24 have approved recreational marijuana. In October 2022, Biden directed health officials to expedite a review of whether marijuana should remain a Schedule I substance. In August, the Department of Health and Human Services notified DEA that it was recommending marijuana be reclassified. The agency relied on a Food and Drug Administration scientific analysis that found marijuana has an accepted medical use and evidence it can treat certain conditions, including nausea and vomiting. It also cited studies showing moderate benefit of smoking marijuana for pain. The reclassification may have only a limited impact on criminal justice cases involving marijuana. Biden has granted pardons for federal marijuana possession cases, and federal prosecutors generally prioritize drug dealers involved with deadly substances such as fentanyl. Cannabis advocates Tuesday hailed the potential change as a milestone that will transform how the federal government treats marijuana, signaling that the dangers have been overblown and that criminal cases should assume a lower priority. This is going to help to normalize cannabis more than anything that's ever occurred in the U.S. since they started the war on drugs, said David Culver, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs at the U.S. Cannabis Council, an industry advocacy group. Quoting, "This is the most significant federal cannabis reform in modern history, and I think sets us on a path for the ultimate goal of federal legalization." Still, cannabis advocates who want to see marijuana regulated like tobacco and alcohol point out that even if the drug is reclassified, it remains a federally controlled substance subject to prosecution. Those involved in the state legal marijuana industry and the tens of millions of Americans who patronize that industry are all acting in a manner that is inconsistent with federal law, said Paul Armentano, deputy director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, an advocacy group. Theoretically, if the federal government wished to do so, all of these players could be prosecuted for being in violation of the federal law. At the state level, the rapid legalization of marijuana has facilitated the rise of a booming industry of growers, processors, dispensaries, and other cannabis companies. But the industry has struggled in recent years as it faced continued competition from the illicit market, along with a glut of supply in some states that drove down prices. States collected $3.77 billion in cannabis taxes in 2022, down from $3.86 billion in 2021, in the first ever decline in revenue, according to a report from the Marijuana Policy Project. Under IRS Code 280E, businesses that sell Schedule I substances cannot deduct business expenses, resulting in a significantly higher tax rate for companies that grow and sell marijuana. But with marijuana reclassified, they will be eligible for the tax breaks. Calico Castile, former board president of the Minority Cannabis Business Association, said many cannabis companies have struggled to become profitable in part because of high taxes. This will potentially help small businesses who are struggling around the country get into the black, Castile said. My concern is, although this will provide some relief for small businesses, it may actually lead to more consolidation and smoking out smaller players. The long-expected recommendation could have political implications for the Biden campaign. Democratic senators have pushed Biden to go further and completely decriminalize marijuana. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is going to bring to an end my portion of this morning's reading. Please, it looks like it's going to be a beautiful day out there today. Enjoy it.
United Health grew very big. Now some lawmakers want to chop it down. After becoming pregnant, Alexandra Day, a 31-year-old consultant living in South Carolina, sought out neonatal genetic testing that was covered in her health insurance policy. But her insurer, United Healthcare, balked at paying for the December 2022 test, claiming there was no proof Day needed it, and billed her $3,900, according to documents reviewed by the Washington Post. Day succeeded in persuading the healthcare colossus to reduce her bill after weeks of telephone calls, letters, and paperwork, ultimately paying $650 and abandoning her effort to try to lower the bill further. The episode left a bitter taste, particularly after United Healthcare became locked in a contracting fight and stopped covering care at South Carolina's largest not-for-profit health system, threatening Day's access to longtime physicians. "They've made it so complicated that nobody can use this system," Day said, drawing a lesson from her work trying to simplify companies' supply chains. "Bigger is not always more efficient. Bigger is more convoluted." In healthcare, no one is bigger than United Health Group, the nation's largest private health insurer and largest employer of physicians. The nearly $400 billion umbrella company also helps run hospitals has rapidly acquired outpatient surgery centers, is expanding into home health services, and fell victim to a cyber attack this winter that brought the U.S. healthcare system to its knees and has prompted congressional hearings this week. Tens of millions of Americans regularly interact with one or several of the company's approximately 2,200 subsidiaries, including middlemen that handle payment processes and pharmaceutical prescriptions, often without realizing it. UnitedHealth ranks as the nation's fourth largest company by revenue this year, just behind Apple and ahead of tech giants Alphabet and Microsoft. In many parts of the country, a patient could be a UnitedHealth customer from cradle to grave, starting with obstetric care and ending with hospice services. The company says its acquisitions have helped it coordinate and align incentives and deliver what industry leaders refer to as value-based care, with providers working together to achieve a shared goal of high-quality, low-cost healthcare. The U.S. health system remains deeply fragmented, UnitedHealth said in a statement. We are organized to help reduce that fragmentation, enabling us to focus on the whole patient. Critics point to UnitedHealth's $22 billion profit last year, saying the company's focus is on benefiting itself while adding costs for consumers. They've grown too big for this country's good, and for their own good, said Don Berwick, a Harvard-affiliated physician who oversaw Medicare and Medicaid during the Obama administration. Success for UnitedHealth is return for investors. For decades, UnitedHealth's staggering growth attracted relatively little Washington scrutiny, particularly compared with drug makers repeatedly summoned to Congress to testify on price increases. Federal antitrust officials also traditionally focused on blocking companies from gobbling up direct competitors, known as horizontal integration, while being more permissive of the strategy practiced by UnitedHealth, which involves buying a stake in different sectors of the same industry, known as a vertical integration. But lawmakers and regulators are beginning to frame UnitedHealth's sweeping operations as an economic and national security concern. Exhibit A, the February cyber attack on a UnitedHealth subsidiary that processed more than 40% of the nation's medical claims. The hack froze payments, preventing many hospitals, doctors, and other providers from being paid for weeks. It also interfered with patients' prescriptions and caused industry paralysis still being repaired today. If you have a third of the health system's dollars going through one company's leaky pipes, that's not an antitrust problem, it's a national security problem, said Jeff Goldsmith, an industry analyst who estimates that more than 5% of U.S. gross domestic product flows through the company's systems every day. UnitedHealth leaders have said hackers used compromised credentials to access its subsidiary Change Healthcare on February 12th and spent the subsequent 9 days moving within Change Healthcare's systems and stealing data. A group that claimed responsibility and demanded ransom payment has said it stole sensitive information linked to tens of millions of patients. House lawmakers this month held a hearing reviewing the cyber attack, and the Senate Finance Committee and the House Energy and Commerce Committee summoned UnitedHealth CEO Andrew Witty to testify Wednesday. It will be the first time in 15 years that the company's CEO has testified on Capitol Hill, according to the Senate Historical Office. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, who chairs the Senate panel set to grill Witty, said it's high time for the CEO to answer lawmakers' questions about its operations, such as the company's frequent use of a practice known as prior authorization, in which physicians must submit additional paperwork to justify their treatments and prescriptions, and patients such as Day are hit with bills they are not expecting. I have very serious questions about UnitedHealth's size and its role in an increasing healthcare costs, Wyden added. We get regular stories about how UnitedHealth is delaying and denying care. The cyber attack put a spotlight on UnitedHealth's $13 billion purchase of Change Healthcare in 2021, part of more than $60 billion of acquisitions in the past decade. That's more than triple what it spent on acquisitions the previous decade, according to transactions logged by data provider FactSet. Lawmakers in both parties said they're unhappy about so much of America's health system running through a single organization, making thousands of hospitals and doctors vulnerable to a single point of failure. "It needs to be busted up," Representative Buddy Carter, Republican of Georgia, said at the congressional hearing on Change Healthcare this month, citing his frustrations as a practicing pharmacist who dealt with UnitedHealth and its subsidiaries. "UnitedHealth is so damn big," added Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, singling out the company's $227 billion Optum division, which employs more than 90,000 physicians. "One in every 10 doctors in America has been sucked into the Optum system. Most patients probably don't know that their doctors are working for a giant corporation bent on maximizing profit instead of working for themselves," Warren said. Federal regulators opted not to fight many of UnitedHealth's acquisitions as it grew from a regional Minnesota operator in the 1970s to a national conglomerate in the 2000s. Biden officials have adopted a more aggressive approach. The Justice Department challenged UnitedHealth's acquisition of Change Healthcare, though a Trump-appointed federal judge dismissed the case, and has launched a review of UnitedHealth's physician group purchases and other practices, according to three people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss a federal probe. The Justice Department declined to comment. Speaking to a conference of emergency physicians in April, Jonathan Cantor, the Justice Department's top antitrust enforcement official, did not mention UnitedHealth by name, according to two physicians and another attendee. But Cantor repeatedly criticized the playbook followed by UnitedHealth, such as how health insurers' strategy to purchase physician practices has allowed them to circumvent federal rules intended to force insurers to spend more money on patient care. "We talk about value-based healthcare," Cantor said, invoking the mantra used by UnitedHealth and other industry players, according to the three attendees. "How about we bring values back to healthcare?" UnitedHealth has worked to head off criticism on Capitol Hill. The company has spent at least $49 million on lobbying efforts during the past decade, employing more than 130 lobbyists, including former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, Republican of Mississippi, former House Majority Leader Richard A. Gephardt, Democrat of Missouri, and nine other former lawmakers, to defend its interests in Washington, according to congressional records and a database maintained by Open Secrets, a nonpartisan organization tracking money in politics. UnitedHealth also hired Danielle Gray, a former senior Obama White House and Justice Department official, to oversee its Washington operations beginning this month. The company declined to make Witte available for an interview. In this month's earnings call, the CEO said UnitedHealth would continue seeking opportunities to acquire businesses, even as he minimized his company's role and influence. "We're a comparatively small part of the $5 trillion U.S. health system," Witte said. The juggernaut now known as UnitedHealth Group traces its origins to a small Minnesota business, Charter Med, founded 50 years ago to handle physicians' business functions at a fledgling health maintenance organization. The company then began operating and purchasing other HMOs, incorporated as UnitedHealth Group, and embarked on a steady run of acquisitions, propelling its ascent on Fortune's list of America's largest companies. UnitedHealth ranked 303rd in 1995, 40th in 2005, and 6th in 2016, its first year in the top 10. Today, UnitedHealth provides health coverage to about 50 million patients through its UnitedHealthcare Insurance Division. It operates one of the largest pharmacy benefit managers, OptumRx, which helps determine what customers pay for prescriptions. Its smallest but most profitable segment presides over the financial pipework, such as processing medical claims, that much of the health system relies on, as many discovered after the February cyberattack. Amanda Stark, Associate Professor of Strategy at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, said UnitedHealth's mergers can provide genuine economic benefits, such as streamlining how healthcare is delivered and cutting out middlemen, so long as those mergers don't lead to monopolies. "Competition is the best kind of disinfectant for high costs and other economic problems," Stark said. Moving on, a quieter border eases pressure on Biden, with a hand from Mexico. in San Diego. Illegal crossings along the U.S.-Mexico border are down more than 40% since December and have remained relatively stable through the first 4 months of 2024, bringing a modest reprieve for President Biden on an issue regarded as a liability to his re-election campaign. Crossings often increase sharply during early spring, but that did not happen for the first time since Biden took office. In April, U.S. border agents have encountered about 130,000 migrants who entered illegally from Mexico, a level that is high by historical standards, but lower than February and March, according to the latest U.S. enforcement data obtained by the Washington Post. U.S. officials say a crackdown on migrants by the Mexican government is the biggest factor. Using military patrols and highway checkpoints, Mexican authorities have been intercepting roughly 8,000 U.S.-bound migrants per day, according to officials in both countries. Mexico launched its campaign at the behest of U.S. officials after illegal crossings soared in December to nearly 250,000, an all-time high, further eroding Biden's poll ratings on border security. Former President Donald Trump, the likely Republican nominee for the November election, continues to criticize Biden's immigration record at campaign rallies, but the relative calm along the border has eased some of the pressure on the president to announce harsher enforcement measures, which could anger some Democrats. Crossings typically increase during spring when seasonal hirings pick up in the United States. The only other time this century that crossings declined during the springtime months was 2017, after Trump took office promising to deport millions, said Adam Isaacson, a border security analyst who tracks monthly enforcement data at the Washington Office on Latin America, a D.C.-based advocacy group. "This spring has been an anomaly," Isaacson said. "It's gotten much, much harder for migrants to make it to the U.S. border." U.S. border officials say the next several weeks will be a key test, because May has often been a peak month for illegal entries. The number of migrants stopped by Mexican authorities in recent months far exceeds the number Mexico has deported, indicating that there may be hundreds of thousands biding time until the crackdown fades. "The real question is, when does the dam burst in Mexico?" Isaacson said. Signs of a potential upswing are already evident in the San Diego area, where smugglers have been sending more and more groups of migrants from South America and Asia to cross through the mountains. In recent weeks, the San Diego sector of U.S. Customs and Border Protection has surpassed others in Arizona and Texas to become the busiest along the southern border for the first time since 1997. The decline in crossings this spring has been pronounced in Texas, where illegal entries are down about 50%. Governor Greg Abbott, Republican, has claimed that his state-run crackdown, Operation Lone Star, is redirecting smugglers to easier routes farther west. Biden officials point to other explanations, noting that the Mexican states opposite the Texas border are notorious for migrant killings and kidnappings. Aaron Waters, a spokesperson for CPB, said in a statement that the agency maintains vigilance to continually shifting migration patterns and will continue to adjust operations as necessary. Some migrants from Colombia avoid the Mexican highway checkpoints by flying into the Tijuana airport from the Mexican resort city of Cancun, where they can travel as tourists. Ecuadorians fly to El Salvador and travel north from there, according to U.S. officials. Peruvian migrants have been flying to Tijuana, but the Mexican government has imposed new visa restrictions that take effect May 6th, one reason U.S. officials think more Peruvians may be attempting to cross the U.S. border now. Mexican enforcement along the south side of the border remains spotty. At a steep mountain pass, east of San Diego known as the Valley of the Moon, for its rugged lunar terrain, smugglers driving vans and trucks drop migrants at a popular crossing point, where the U.S. border wall ends. Border Patrol cameras monitor the groups as they hike down the mountain amid boulders and thorny cactuses to turn themselves into U.S. agents, the first step in applying for U.S. humanitarian protection. It's less than a mile to a roadside meeting point along U.S. Interstate 8, where U.S. border agents have set up a makeshift waiting area with latrines and drinking water. Nonprofit and church groups arrive from San Diego to deliver food and firewood for the bonfires migrants build to stay warm. The Border Patrol transports families with children first, so single adult migrants may spend hours, sometimes days, waiting for a ride. On a recent weekday morning, South American migrants shivered in the cold alongside smaller groups from China, India, and Turkey. A few families with small children took refuge inside crude shelters and tents. Acrid smoke from bonfires burning plastic and garbage wafted through the camp. Many of the nationalities arriving in the San Diego area are the same that crossed through the Yuma, Arizona area in 2022 and early 2023. Smugglers have shifted to routes west, CPB officials say, due to shifting Mexican enforcement as well as cartel infighting. Teresa Cardinal Brown, a migration expert at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington, said month-to-month changes in border crossings are less important than what she described as a paradigm shift toward the globalization of border crossings. More than 80% of the migrants encountered by U.S. authorities along the southern border in 2021 were from Mexico and Central America, CBP data shows. This year, it's dropped to 50%. There's been a fundamental change in who is coming and how they're coming, Cardinal Brown said. That makes it harder for the U.S. immigration system to provide due process to asylum seekers and impose consequences, deportations, for those who don't qualify for protection, she said. The Biden administration has increasingly turned to Mexico for help. Mexico has agreed to take back up to 30,000 migrants per month, the first time it has agreed to accept significant numbers of non-Mexicans. Biden and Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador discussed migration during an April 28th call, according to a joint statement released Monday. The two leaders discussed how to effectively manage hemispheric migration and strengthen operational efficiency on our shared border, the statement said. U.S. officials say they have sent roughly 700,000 migrants back to their home countries or Mexico since the Biden administration lifted pandemic-era border controls nearly a year ago, the biggest deportation operation since 2011. CBP continues to work with our partners throughout the hemisphere, including the government of Mexico and around the world, to disrupt the criminal organizations and transportation networks who take advantage of and profit from vulnerable migrants, Waters' statement said. In December, when the budget of Mexico's immigration agencies ran low, tens of thousands of migrants rode freight trains to the U.S. border facing little resistance. The chaotic mass crossings supercharged Republican attacks on Biden. CBP suspended entries at several U.S. ports of entry for rail and freight cargo, putting pressure on Mexico. And after a call with López Obrador, Biden sent a team led by Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to Mexico City on December 27th. Mexico remains sensitive to the perception that it's carrying out the dirty work for the United States by stopping migrants, but its government has been more outspoken about the results of its crackdown. In a statement to the Post, Mexico's foreign ministry said the drop in illegal crossings along the U.S. southern border was the result of coordinated actions by several governmental agencies taken by Mexico. The statement said Mexico will provide alternatives to seekers of asylum and those looking for labor opportunities, a reference to the record number of migrants applying to live and work in Mexico because they can't reach the United States. They may not stay long. The Biden administration is allowing nearly 1,500 migrants per day to make appointments to go to a U.S. border crossing using a government mobile app, CBP One, and start the process of applying for U.S. humanitarian protection. It can take several months to secure an appointment, and some of those taken into custody after crossing illegally said they lost patience with CBP or feared for their safety in Mexico. Central American nations, especially Guatemala and Honduras, are the focus of the Biden administration's root causes strategy, led by Vice President Harris. The number of Central Americans stopped at the U.S. border fell nearly 30% from 2021 to 2023, according to Marcela Escobari, a Biden advisor working on the root causes plan. And finally for this week, Trump held in contempt after violating gag order in hush money trial. Former President Donald Trump was held in contempt of court Tuesday for repeatedly violating a gag order, and the judge overseeing his ongoing criminal trial warned him that he could go to jail if he keeps breaking the court's rules. Defendant is hereby warned that the court will not tolerate continued violations of its lawful orders, and that if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarceratory punishment, New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan wrote in an 8-page ruling finding Trump violated the order on 9 occasions. Merchan ruled that Trump was in contempt of court for violations of a gag order that was imposed to protect the safety of people involved in the hush money trial and their families. Trump purposely violated the order in his Truth Social posts and campaign materials, the judge said, and his behavior warranted a finding of contempt and a $9,000 fine, $1,000 per each violation. The judge ordered the 9 offending posts deleted, and within hours of his ruling, they were gone. The warning delivered by Marchand envisions a scenario even more incredible than the first trial of a former U.S. president, one in which the defendant could be locked up at some point before there is a verdict. It's unclear to what degree the low-key Merchan wants to engage in a public game of chicken with the presumptive GOP nominee for president, pardon me. In court, the judge calmly delivered his ruling at the start of the day's proceedings and did not speak directly to Trump from the bench. Trump listened impassively to the judge's decision, and it was difficult to gauge what he made of the contempt finding. His lawyers said they wanted time to study the written decision before making further argument. After the Trump's ruling, Trump's campaign issued an appeal for campaign donations, saying the Democrat judge just ruled against me. Trump is due to make campaign stops Wednesday in the Midwest, where he will have more opportunities to violate the gag order if he chooses. The judge's contempt finding kicked off the second week of trial testimony, but most of what the jury heard Tuesday centered around the actions not of Trump, but of his former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen. Cohen is a key prosecution witness in this case, but comes to the role with significant baggage, having previously pleaded guilty to federal crimes, including lying. Trump is charged with 34 counts of falsifying business records for allegedly disguising a $130,000 hush money payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels before the 2016 presidential election, money that was first paid by Cohen and later reimbursed by Trump through transactions that Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg charges amounted to crimes. Even as the judge issued a stern warning to Trump over contempt of court, he also sent a message to Cohen and Daniels, both of whom have repeatedly criticized Trump in social media posts and interviews. The judge warned Cohen and Daniels that if they continue to criticize Trump publicly, he might decide his gag order barring Trump from talking about the witnesses should no longer apply to them. The contempt finding came on a day of lengthy testimony by a Los Angeles lawyer who was enmeshed in the deals that were struck in 2016 to try to keep quiet alleged sexual liaisons between the presidential candidate and Karen McDougal, a Playboy model, and Stormy Daniels. The lawyer, Keith Davidson, sometimes described the negotiation for those deals, which were angry, sometimes rushed, and involved six-figure payouts to the women to keep quiet. Davidson said McDougal ended up in something of a bidding war between AMI, the company that published the National Enquirer, and ABC, which he alleged had dangled the prospect of putting McDougal on the cast of Dancing with the Stars if she told her story about an alleged affair with Trump. A representative for ABC declined to comment on Davidson's testimony. The lawyer, often testifying with a wry smile on his face as he described the inner workings of deals that were never supposed to become public, was shown a text he sent at the time in which he said some of McDougal's friends were pushing her to choose ABC, because then her story of an affair with Trump would be made public. "The girl is being cornered by the estrogen mafia," Davidson texted at the time. On the witness stand, he called the comment unfortunate and regrettable, saying it was not his term, but a phrase one of McDougal's associates used at the time. For hours Tuesday, the jury heard Davidson offer a detailed description of the often tumultuous negotiations to buy the silence of two women who Cohen and others feared could hurt Trump's presidential campaign. Davidson said that Daniels' account of a tryst with Trump years earlier had been rumored, but there was little interest in buying her account until the Washington Post reported in October 2016 that Trump had made offensive comments about grabbing women in an Access Hollywood recording. After that, Davidson said, the interest in Daniels reached a quick crescendo, and he helped negotiate what became a $130,000 deal with Cohen to keep Daniels silent. But after signing the deal, Cohen failed to turn over the money by the agreed-upon date, leading to more acrimonious exchanges. At one point, Davidson said, he walked away from the entire thing before coming back to the table to finalize the matter. The moral of the story is no one wanted to talk to Cohen, Davidson said, describing the lawyer as untrustworthy, high-strung, and prone to screaming. The jury also heard Tuesday from the banker who helped Cohen create an account for him to wire the money to Davidson and Daniels, and a C-SPAN archivist who verified certain 2016 campaign videos in which Trump denied allegations made by women against him. Mershon told Trump on Tuesday that the case was proceeding quickly enough that he would allow him to attend his son's high school graduation in mid-May. Trump did not visibly react in court to the ruling, but on social media he accused the judge of racing too fast through the evidence. The trial is going like a speeding bullet, Trump wrote in a social media post that called Mershon rigged, crooked, and above all and without question, conflicted, in all caps. It's a disgrace to our country. They've taken away my right to free speech. Election interference, again in all caps. That takes us to the end of this Wednesday's Washington Post. Tripp and Bill and I will be back next week. Take care until then.